Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, encouraging you to eat healthfully and nutritionally. Visit bobsredmill.com to learn more about their products. And use the code TASTE25 for 25% off your order.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And it's no secret that America has had a long-running love affair with cookies. You name it, cookies, biscuits, whatever you called them, past, present. And of course, then along came big business, and there was advertisers who made us fall in love with all kinds of brands of cookies. And you know their names. Keebler and their little elves, Pepperidge Farm, Famous Amos, Pillsbury, Little Debbie, Archway, Snackwell. Stop me when I get to your favorite. Snackwell, Mrs. Fields, Walker's, Newton's, Newman's. I'm sure there are so many more that I'm missing, but of course I couldn't leave out Nabisco. The world's best-selling cookie just recently celebrated their 100th anniversary, about 12 years ago, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, whatever. Michael will tell me. My guest today knows everything. I'm relying on him. Oreos celebrated their 100th anniversary a few years ago. I'll start from the top end. And it is really a testament, I don't think necessarily to the cookie itself, probably more to the advertising of this big business. But it's interesting that around that cookie and several other cookies grew manufacturers, factories that were set up precisely to make all these delectable little sweet treats. And interestingly enough, crackers too, figure the same thing. Ovens, extruders, whatever. But we'll get to that and we'll talk to that. And Oreo still remains, I mean, it is the iconic cookie, I think the manufactured cookie. Of course, a chocolate chip cookie would be the homemade cookie, right? That's what we all love and think of and can smell in our dreams. Maybe it's just me. But Oreo is the cookie that kind of took the market on. I did a little informal polling of friends and phone calls and Facebook, and hands down, Chips Ahoy and Oreo came in at the top. And interestingly enough, both Chips Ahoy and Nabisco and Oreos are made by Nabisco. And they happen to be the number one and number two best-selling cookie in America. Oreos being number one, Chips Ahoy number two. And there are so many other cookies that are so popular. And here to talk with me about this sweet craze and love affair, and the history, of course, of the Oreo, is the guy who knows all things sweet, the sweet guy himself, Michael Crandall. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks so much.
Michael is a food writer and an artist, no stranger to my show, and he's the author of Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert, and A Taste of Conquest, The Rise and Fall of the Three Great Cities of Spice, The Donut, senior editor of Sugar and Sweets, and the list goes on. And he's written for so many magazines and publications, as well as editing another encyclopedia for Oxford, Encyclopedia of Food and Drink. And Michael, whenever I have anything to talk about that includes sweetness, I always think of you first. So glad you could come on the show today.
I'm delighted to be here.
All right, let's talk about this love affair with cookies. We talked a little bit before the show went on, and you, interestingly enough, were not subjected to that whole onslaught of advertising and the craze of the manufactured cookie.
Well, I didn't grow up in the United States, so for me, Oreos are this kind of curious anthropological item that I'm fascinated by, kind of as, you know, someone coming to a different culture might be fascinated by strange local food habits. And because the Oreo is in some ways so central to American ideas of childhood at this point and is so kind of linked with it, it is, you know, as an anthropologist almost, you think of it as so loaded with signification to for everyone here. I've never acquired the taste, I must confess, but I understand the pleasure of having watched my daughter, who grew up here, seeing the pleasure of separating the cookie and the rituals that go along with that,
and licking that filling.
Which was promoted by the Nabisco Company in the 1950s in their ads. Yes, so much of it does have to do with Nabisco kind of taking a biscuit, they wouldn't have called it a cookie at the time, a biscuit that was originally intended for kind of upper middle class ladies entertaining,
having tea, a tea snack.
Transforming that into a childhood treat. And, you know, this happens like many of these things after the Second World War, because it is only after the Second World War that you can reach children directly through television.
Right.
Prior to that, advertising went to adults because children didn't read.
In fact, the Oreos we were talking about, the Oreos were originally marketed and advertised to women.
Oh, absolutely.
Housewives.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, I actually, just before coming in here, I sort of looked at an ad in a 1927 Good Housekeeping. And if you don't mind, I'll just read a very, very brief bit of it. So these are impromptu desserts. When you have been kept later than you expected at the bridge game, matinee or whatnot, and have failed to make your dessert in advance, what can be so comforting as that biscuit shelf at home replete with a variety of goodies? And then the Nabisco goes on to talk about their marshmallow assorted, their Oreo sandwiches. Note that they're called Oreo sandwiches. They're not called cookies. They're not called biscuits. Oreo sandwiches, chocolate minarets, chocolate pecan creams, all very sophisticated.
Interesting. But Nabisco now. Nabisco started out making, the National Biscuit Company started out making other things. Let's take a few steps back where Oreos and how Oreos originated, what we can find out and what we can, what
yeah.
we know.
Yeah. So Nabisco is, there was this trend in the late 19th century of trusts, that is various companies buying each other out or colluding to create giant corporations. The Sugar Trust was created. There was, of course, the famous Petroleum Trust created by the Rockefellers. And there was, in fact, a biscuit trust that came together in the late 19th century. Eventually, several companies from across the country combined into the National Biscuit Company, thus Nabisco, the National Biscuit Company, that was consolidated eventually at the beginning of the 19th century, moved to New York City, because one forgets this, but New York City was a major food manufacturing hub, because you'd get sugar coming in here from the Caribbean, Cuba, and places like that. You would get grain coming in here from the Midwest. They'd put it back together, you know, they'd put it together in various edible forms and ship it out to the rest of the country. So some of the largest Nabisco's big competitor and the people who claim that they actually came up with the sandwich cookie had a giant factory out in New York City, in Long Island City, and it was at the time the largest factory in the world.
I've seen drawings of it.
Right.
I don't think they were actual pictures. Right, they were drawings, and huge.
Right.
Now it's located in the Chelsea Market is located in what was the Nabisco.
That's the Nabisco. Nabisco, and it was actually this other company, the Lou's Wills Company, that claims they came up with the original version of the sandwich cookies and the so-called Hydrox cookie, which precedes Oreos by a couple of years.
And we're talking turn of the century, right?
So Hydrox is 1908, Oreo is 1912.
Right.
To what degree one company ripped off the other is a long simmering argument that I don't have the solution to.
Now, was Hydrox made by the Sunshine Baking Company? Where does Sunshine come in? Wasn't Sunshine a company making
Sunshine Specialties was the name of the overall brand. There was owned by the Loose Willis Biscuit Company. So, I mean, there's multiple sort of names on names on names that have to do with marketing. So, you know, Nabisco creates all these names for stuff.
Yeah. Well, there was interesting story, but it's a well-known fact on how Nabisco had to change the formula for the cream filling in the cookies, and that's why Hydrox was always sort of staying abreast for a while.
Well, the original formula, as best as I know, contained lard.
Right.
And that became an issue for a variety of reasons.
Right. It was not kosher, Hydrox did not use the lard, so they continued to have a market share.
They did. The Hydrox disappeared at one point, and they reappeared in the last decade or so. I'm not really sure if they're still available today.
Yeah, interesting. We don't even know where the name comes from, do we? Oreo?
No, this is actually given that it is the world's most popular cookie, you know, 450 billion sold in the 20th century. We don't actually know where the name comes from. There's lots of speculation. But there's no documents of any of this. You know, it was probably a bunch of people, you know, sitting in the back of the bakery saying, oh, well, can we... Because naming was very important. Nabisco made its name, its fortune in those days with something called a Unita biscuit.
That's right.
Unita
biscuit.
which was vastly more popular than anything like an Oreo.
Yeah. It was more a very plain... very like childlike,
kind of a digestive biscuit, type,
like a digestive
biscuit. Right. Yeah. But chocolate wasn't a super popular flavor in those days, so it really took chocolate taking off as a significant flavor. Because originally they made Oreos both in a vanilla and a chocolate version, which has since been reintroduced. But it was dropped, I think, in the 1920s or something like that. But chocolate wasn't super popular until really Hershey's made chocolate bars ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And then people got used to eating chocolate, and then chocolate cookies, whether they were chocolate chip, chocolate wafer cookies, what have you, became much more popular.
It changed the industry.
You know, after the wars, in part because the servicemen came back having had lots and lots of Hershey's chocolate bars or later M&M's. As part of their service packets.
Huh, interesting. The versions that you mentioned that they are still making, they brought back the vanilla version that they made originally. They've tried in, you know, their marketing campaigns so many different
versions. Oh, these days, I can't even keep up. And even if I could keep up next week, there's going to be something else coming out. But, you know, that has to do with shelf space on supermarkets' shelves, right? So that... if you have only Oreos, they will take up X amount of space. If you have 16 different kinds of Oreos, they will take up the entire aisle.
Well, it's interesting, even their Chips Ahoy, they have many different varieties of those cookies. But back to the Oreos, they came out with the double stuffed and the super stuffed and then the thin ones and the now flavored ones.
Right, and now because it is so kind of embedded in the culture, of course, you have fried Oreos at theme parks and that sort of thing.
Yeah, country fairs. Yes,
absolutely.
Yes, deep fried Oreos. Never had one of those. And then there was the milk campaign. And I mean, what better way to push drinking a glass of milk than dunking your Oreo in the
milk, it's right? Really hard to convince parents, or to be more accurate, mothers, that Oreos are good for you.
Yeah.
And so how do you do that? Well, you say that, okay, if you have Oreos and you dunk them in milk, all of a sudden you've turned something that is, you know, sugar and fat with a little bit of carbs to hold it all together into something that supposedly is good for you. So it becomes a wholesome afternoon snack instead of just being sugar and Crisco.
Well, you mentioned the word and the naming and where the word or the origins of the word. Of course, we know we have the Dutch to thank for our act, more or less our word cookie.
We do, we do. No, I mean, the word cookie is a Dutch loan word. It shows up. I'd actually before this episode, I did a little bit of digging in old dictionaries, and it actually shows up in Scottish dictionaries, oddly enough. So it may have been prevalent even in Scotland in the early days. Specifically as a Dutch loan word, they specifically say that. And it was very much of what seems to be a regionalism in the New York City, Hudson Valley area, because, of course, this is where the Dutch settlement was. And shows up quite early in various documents, and always sort of as, oh, look at this funny word that they use in this part of the country, because they would have in New England used the word biscuit or jumbles or
wafer. Yeah. And it was more like what cook. I'm going to pronounce it all wrong, but kukje.
I think it would, and I should say, because Dutch is pronounced in a way that I don't understand, but as best as I know, it's kukje.
Kukje. All right, that's close enough.
It's close enough. But it doesn't become kind of the standard word until the second half of the 19th century.
Interesting, yeah. And biscuit, of course, was little cakes were called biscuits, and they were sweet. And if you look back to America's first cookbooks, Amelia Simmons and those books, biscuits were always not savory necessarily. They were sweet, and they were like cookies.
Well, biscuit, it comes from the French, biscuit, twice cooked, and they were hardtack. They were originally stuff that sailors and soldiers would have. In fact, one of the reasons that the popularity of something like Nabisco was possible, because during the Civil War, a large company started manufacturing huge quantities of these biscuits, which were more like crackers, really. So the soldiers on the Northern Front would get all these supplies, and they got used to eating these biscuits, which presumably were not quite as reprehensible as the biscuits the sailors got in the 18th century, which were all wormy and horrible.
Yeah. But hardtack, I mean, they put hardtack in the back of their packs, and hard is, you know, understatement.
Right,
we could break a tooth
on
those.
But in the same way that, you know, in the same way that in Italy, biscotto originally meant hardtack, and
right,
it turned into a, you know, this delightful cookie.
Right.
In England, the original biscuit turned into a biscuit, which was still the hardtack, which eventually turned into the English word for a cookie. And even today, the British use primarily the word biscuit.
So we're placing Oreos around 1912
for Oreos.
Nabisco, right?
Yeah, they get their patent in 1912.
The sandwich cookies, and boy, they are making a comeback in modern baking as well. I love the, you know, Stella Parks. She's the Brave Tart.
These like kind of hipster versions,
retakes of classic,
of
retro
classics,
desserts.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about the manufacturing of biscuits and cookies when we come back after a short break, so stay tuned. Hi, I want to take this opportunity to tell you about one of Bob's Red Mill's great products, They have so many terrific flowers and seeds and grains. But something that I didn't realize they carried until I happened to notice it on the shelf in the grocery store the other day was Masaharina. And I was so happy that I found it. Masaharina is, masa actually, is a Spanish word for dough. And it is a corn flour. So it's a nice, it's not ground too finely, but it's fine enough that it's wonderful to use for tortillas and what I particularly like making with, I'm a little intimidated to make my own tortillas. Am I going to get them thin enough? Am I going to get them round enough? Are they going to look just right? But what I make without trepidation are tamales with the Masaharina. And a lot of people think, oh, but that's such a difficult thing to make. And, you know, it's not. It takes a little bit of prep time. But the Masaharina makes such a wonderful base for any filling that you come up with. So whether you're making a chicken, you know, if you have leftovers too, you can turn it into some a saucy pulled pork, a saucy chicken or beef. And the tamales really come together very quickly. You might have to make a special effort to go out and buy your corn husks, but the tamales, you just take a few cups, depending on how many you're making. Don't follow my proportions here. I'm just giving you the ideas of taking the Masaharina, a few cups of the Masaharina, add, like for 4 cups, add a teaspoon of baking powder and maybe a half a teaspoon of salt and mix that all together. Then stir up some lard and a chili paste. Now, if you don't like lard, you can always use shortening, butter, but mix that into them until it's a little kind of fluffy with your chili paste, and then add some broth, whatever broth you're making, whatever matches the filling that you're using in your tamale, and you smear some of that on your corn husk, and then put the filling in the center and fold it up. Oh, I can taste it now. Bob's Red Mill, always making great products. And you can find these and other products on their website at bobsredmill.com and use the code TastePod for 25% off your order. Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Michael Crandall, the knower of all things sweet in history. And Michael, you know, we established the Oreo, but do you have any idea when the first commercialized cookie, cracker, biscuit, whatever was it? I mean, they had...
Sure, they were in Britain. The early industrialization of food comes in Britain, and they begin to produce things like shortbread, which we, you know, think of, oh, wouldn't it be delightful to make some shortbread at home? But in fact, it was initially hugely industrialized because you could industrialize it. And then various kinds of tea biscuits were also created, which is where, you know, the idea that Nabisco got these ideas to begin with. One of the interesting things about the manufacture of all of these things in the UK, say in the 1850s, 60s, and so on, is most of the work was done by women and children. So these factories were notorious for child labor. You know, you think of producing these lovely little sweet tea biscuits that you can have, you know, in the afternoon for high tea. But in fact, the working conditions were pretty awful. Mm. In the United States, things became, I think, more automated, and there was more of, it was later, there was more industrial sort of advance at that point. So I don't know that Nabisco necessarily had child labor, although child labor laws were certainly not non-existent at that point when they were making
Oreos. I don't know if you've ever toured a baking factory or any kind of food manufacturer or even any factory. I mean, I just love it. I think that it's just, I could stare at those machines doing whatever they do, whether it's the extruders or the ones that poke the little holes to perforate the crackers.
And particularly when it comes to something like this, there's a Willy Wonka aspect to
it. Absolutely, absolutely. It's fascinating to me. And I don't see any end to it, except that now I am seeing, I mean, obviously we were talking earlier that Commercially made cookies, of course, are not nothing. Well, no cookie is really, you couldn't, as you said before, it's not a health food. You don't pretend that you're eating something.
No, whether
healthy.
It is made, you know, with artisanal butter and, you know, hand harvested sugar, it's still just as bad for you, quite frankly, right. as the stuff that you buy when you open the package.
Yeah, I mean, with a few preservatives in it. Although companies, I think, are taking strides to, you know, to make, you know, they have low sugar.
Well, I think that, that for example, Oreos had to get rid of the hydrogenated fat.
The
trans fat. So I think they had to reformulate things. Now, of course, there's, you know, issues with palm oil, which is going into many of these things. And there will always be, I think, issues. One of the things that I find interesting about Oreos is with globalization of tastes, or with globalization comes globalization of tastes. And Oreos, which I never ever remember seeing in Europe, are now ubiquitous.
Oh, yeah.
You find them everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what that next generation around the world of little kids who've grown up with Oreos, what their reaction to these things is, if it is like that of Americans, or whether they're just like one of these many things that they might have as a childhood snack.
Yeah, it's interesting and a little sad too sometimes when you know in traveling and walking into a supermarket and or you know you see a McDonald's fast food
sure.
place. I mean, kind of like exported all the worst things of America to these other countries, but looking at supermarkets, which were large supermarkets, which were slow to come to many of the countries. There are now, just like here in America,
an entire aisle
devoted to cookies, and not just Oreos. I mean, their own everyone's cookie.
Right. And the reality of it is that, you know, it's probably Mondelez is controlling one half of the cookie market, and Nestle is controlling the other half.
And that's what
many of these are not based in the United States.
Right. And who is this behemoth Mondelez? Mondelez has bought Nabisco, the Oreo portion of it now, right?
That's right. And as best as I know, and again, these things seem to change every 3 years, so I may be 10 years out of day.
Yeah.
Because with mergers and acquisitions, this is constantly changing. But the last I heard, Mondelez was an Anglo-Dutch concern. So even the companies aren't even based in a single country anymore.
Oh, wow. I noticed, I read the other day where Tate's, not the other day, a few months ago, Tate's, which was a local Long Island baking company that produced kind of like, tasted almost like homemade chocolate chip cookies. You know, that's almost like homemade is one of the the brands. I mean, one of the things to market it. And I considered it sort of a small entity, right? Mm-hmm. Mondelez bought them.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mondelez is swallowing up everything left, right,
indeed,
and center.
Indeed.
Well, even the name doesn't seem to have a location. I mean, note that. Mondelez. It's not in a language.
It ends in a Z. Mondelez. Yeah, right. But the Oreos, I mean, it makes sense since you had just mentioned they're all over the world. They're
yes.
in all the countries. Over 100 countries they are distributed. And sold. I mean, like Coca-Cola, you know, it's like,
or like Ben and Jerry's.
Ben and Jerry's now too.
Yeah. Ben and Jerry's.
But wait, who bought them?
Ben and Jerry's was bought by Unilever, and I have to say that, you know, sometimes these things aren't so bad because now you can get Ben and Jerry's in Germany if you want it, and it's the same good Ben and Jerry's.
Hmm. Okay, now back to Oreos, and you said you enjoyed watching your daughter, you knew your daughter enjoyed eating Oreos. You never really acquired a taste for them. But those who do eat them or have eaten them in their childhood, everyone has their own way of eating them. Are you a dunker?
You're asking about me.
You.
I'm not a dunker, no. And I'm not a dunker in general.
And you wrote the book on donuts?
I wrote the book on donuts, and my conviction is the only reason you dunk a donut is if it's old.
Uh-huh.
And okay. I don't want an old donut. There's no reason to dunk a fresh donut. So I sort of feel a little bit the same way about cookies. I don't like the mushy texture that you get from dunking. I like the crispness. I'm just not a dunker.
Do you split it apart and eat the filling first?
You know, again, I'm probably a really bad person to ask about this. I can speak to my daughter, who does split it and eat out the inside and then eats the rest of it. I think the last time I ate an Oreo was about 30 years ago.
I can't even remember when the last time I was, but I do know they're around a lot with grandchildren.
Oh, absolutely.
And children, you know, yeah, so yeah, I know. Yeah. And it seems to go down the middle of the road. I mean, you know, like some split, some don't.
And interestingly enough, the main reason that my daughter was introduced to Oreos is because her grandmother would buy them for her, because, uh-huh, of course, I was a dessert fascist in my home. But, you know, if it's not homemade Apfelstrudel, you're not having it, child. But, you know, her grandmother would sneak her Oreos when I wasn't looking.
Yeah. I'm kind of that way, too, about homemade cookies. I mean, I don't really... Ask me what my favorite brand of cookies are. Yeah, I can remember some good ones. I like Girl Scout cookies. We didn't even talk about Girl Scout cookies. A lot of people I asked liked some of their favorite cookies were Girl Scout cookies brands. Well, now Girl Scouts were done in small regional bakeries and ovens for a long time, and they've over the years been bought out and been, well, sold to, as far as the cooking places, to bigger companies, right?
I think Girl Scout cookies are a perfect example of the same idea as the Oreo, which is that it isn't really what they taste like, it's what they represent. Mm-hmm. But that taste, then, it goes back and forth, right? So you taste something, and then all of a sudden, your memory goes back to the time when you used to have a lot of it, if it was positive, right? And then you have a positive association with the taste, and there's this kind of circle of associations, right, circle of signification. So, you know, taste, smell are the strongest sense. They bring a memory better than other senses.
And particularly
do.
Sweet.
And particularly sweet. And children, it's been statistically documented, children don't have an upper limit for sweetness, so that you add sugar and more sugar and more sugar and more sugar, and a child will not say uncle. Hmm. Whereas an adult at one point will say, this is too sweet. And apparently that develops at some point in adolescence. But to a child, there's no such thing as too sweet, which is, you know, one reason I would say that Girl Scout cookies are beloved of children, because Girl Scout cookies are super, super, super sweet. I don't know if you've had one recently. I have.
No.
I kind of like imagining the research that went into figuring that out. Like, I picture them having like a bunch of kids in a room and just giving them cookies and them looking at each other like, they're not stopping. They're not stopping. They can just keep going.
That's our new engineer, Noam, who just couldn't help himself.
Right? But he's an anthropologist, so it first makes perfect sense.
Right. I just sit in a room with my own kids when they were growing up, and it was like, well, you have to put the brakes on at some point for them. You're right. There's no boundary.
Yeah. And of course, now that when you ply children with various kinds of sodas, there's especially no boundary.
Back to the Oreo, and it translates to the rest of the cookie industry, I would imagine. Oreos were not, I mean, the Nabisco Oreo was a takeoff on the Hydrox cream sandwich cookie. Maybe
not if you asked them.
there was this battle. I know it was.
Oh, there was. Yeah.
Ever a lawsuit? Did they
I don't think it
lawsuit?
Ever actually got quite that far.
Because there's
probably, you know, sufficient differences that the trademark and. You can't, as far as I know, you can't copyright a food. You can only copyright a trademark.
Right. And recipes. We know recipes are very, very difficult to copyright. I put an extra grain of salt in mine, so it's my recipe.
Exactly.
Well, because the reason I asked about that, which, you know, who had the very first, because then, since that day, there have been replications galore of this sandwiched, you know,
the sandwich
cookie with black wafers.
Right.
And Newman's has their own supposedly health conscious which I don't even know. Oh, you go to
a health, yeah, you go to a health food store and there's all sorts of, you know, supposedly good for you Oreos. But again, you know, these are made with the evaporated cane juice, which as far as I know is just sugar.
Still sugar. Right. Well, and Nabisco just didn't stop with Oreos, of course. And Unita, the Unita biscuit, and oh, animal crackers too. They were really one of the very first, weren't they not?
Absolutely. And again, just before coming in here, I sort of looked up briefly what they were making, you know, in the era of the First World War, and they made arrowroot biscuits.
Yeah.
They made champagne wafers. They made 5 o'clock tea biscuits. They made Oswego biscuits, whatever they were. They were making saltines, of course. Unita, and so on and so on and so on. Some 20, 30 products, some of which were sweet, some of which were more cracker-like.
Yeah, and the animal crackers, I think, Fig Newtons, that was their own company, but Fig Newtons and animal crackers really were very, very early brands of cookies or types of cookies that were offered.
And again, with animal crackers, you really were at that point aiming them at children.
Oh, yeah.
Because they could play with them and, you know, all those sorts of things. And I do think that it's that play aspect, that ritual aspect, that to some degree being able to control the way you eat something, which to a child is unusual. Most children are told, or were used to be told, you have to eat it like this.
Don't play with your food.
Don't play with your food. Right. And here's a food that you are supposed to play with. You know, Nabisco telling you on television that you, child, should be playing with this food.
Okay to split it in half. So it's okay to dunk it in your milk.
Right. So it's also transgressive. I mean, you know. Mommy, they said that I could do this.
Yep. Yep. Oh, and our love affair goes on. And as I was starting to say, you know, I'm not big on the packaged cookies. You know, put it in front of me, I probably will have one if I have my cup of tea. But I do like homemade cookies or biscuits. And of course, they're not always available. And then who's going to stop and bake a whole batch of them if I'm trying to get other things done? So that limits my intake.
Of course.
Sugar.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful thing. I mean, cookies have their place in
well, I think, you know, I think pleasure is underrated. You need pleasure from your food, not merely nutrition. Mm. Does that mean that you want pleasure at all times, 24/7? It's less pleasurable when you get it 24/7.
Ask anyone who works in a bakery and what do they want? They probably desire a cheeseburger. You
know? Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Michael, as always, it has been a pleasure. A pleasure on radio talking about sweet things. And I get my pleasure in lots of ways. And talking to you about the sweets is always one of them.
And it's a low calorie treat.
Ah, there you go. Okay. And thanks for listening. Once again, this has been A Taste of the Past.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.